I'm going to call this meeting to order. Welcome to the January 9th, 2018 meeting of the Central Marin Sanitation Agency Commission. First thing on the agenda, Pledge of Allegiance. Would you all please join me?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Kate, would you please call the roll?
Certainly. Chair first. Diane first.
Here.
Mary Beth Bushy.
Here.
Michael Borstein.
Yes, ma'am. Here.
Thomas Gaffney.
Present.
Dan Hilmer.
Here.
And Dean DiGiovanni.
Here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is open time for public participation. Is there any member of the public who would like to speak? Seeing nobody in the audience, I believe that's a no. Let's move on to consent calendar. Purpose of the consent calendar is to pass routine items or items that have been discussed previously. They will be considered and enacted in one motion unless anybody would like to remove an item. Anybody want to remove anything?
I'll move the consent calendar.
Thank you. Was that a second, Mary Beth?
Yep.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. I believe that was unanimous. Thank you. Moving on to agenda item 5, 2017 performance metric report.
Okay. So what we have before the board is the metric report for calendar year 2017. So, you know, we produce a monthly metric report that's included in the board agenda packet's consent calendar. And it's, you know, it has four different parts of the table, one for, you know, public education activities, one for regulatory compliance and environmental inspections through our pollution prevention program, another for some employee metrics, such as overtime, you know, labor hours for different types of work order activities, and then, you know, treatment and process type metrics. And each metric, each area has a definition, then a measurement, and a target range or a goal that we try to meet. And periodically, you know, we'll adjust some of these ranges and goals, and we'll bring those back to the board for consideration approval. And most of the time those are approved, then we update the ranges on the next monthly metric report. So we've been doing this for about 8 or 9 years now. And about 7 years ago, we decided we're gonna roll all this up to an annual report and actually put it on the business calendar for the January meeting to present to the board. So that's what's attached to the staff report. And then over the years, we've started tracking some of the annual metrics in these tables that you see in the staff report. Then we have a very high level kind of overview of why, what causes some of the variances or changes each year. So that's what's shown in the staff report. So I can answer any questions about, you know, any of the metrics, any of the changes over the years generally. A couple things to note. One is on page one, you can see how the total volume of wastewater has changed over time. You know, it's not consistent. A lot of variables, you know, can affect that, primarily the size of wet weather events. So if you look back 2011 and 12, those are normal rain years. Then you had a few years of drought. So you saw the volumes are lower, primarily due to water conservation within the service area. Then you had an increase in 2016 when it started raining again. Then 2017, we had, you know, pretty significant events in January and February, so that contributed to the bigger number in 2017. And then next you see biosols, and there are a few different factors that can, you know, impact biosols production. Notably from 2014 through 17, you see there's a little growth, and that's due to the additional material we're receiving through the organic waste program for the most part. But anyways, I just want to kind of highlight, you know, what some of the trends are and why, and answer any questions you have. But from a staff perspective, you know, the metrics over this last year look pretty good. I guess one other thing I'd point out on page two, the last bullet, and these are inspections that our environmental compliance staff perform. And these are under our pretreatment, federal pretreatment program inspections, our pollution prevention inspections, our fog source control program inspections for other agencies, as well as our mercury reduction program inspections. 2017, we had quite a few lower inspections, lower number, and that's due to a couple factors. One, our long-term environmental services manager, Rob Cole, He retired in October 2016, and he was heavily involved in the management of the program and did a lot of work himself. And we learned, you know, after he left that a lot of his staff weren't trained on a lot of the core aspects of their job in terms of managing the accounts and all the activities to inspect and write reports and follow up, things like that. So part of the reduction was Rob not being here, retraining the staff. Then also we have one of our environmental service analysts has been on extended leave throughout 2017, so it's been a small reduction in the workforce. But in talking with the technical services manager, he said, you know, the staff have been trained, and we'll increase inspections next year. One thing that's going to happen is that I'm going to have to report to the GAK managers that under the fog source control contracts, we didn't meet our targets last year, and we might be even a little lower this year until we figure out what happens with that person that's on this extended, you know, leave of absence, and if we can find, you know, a specialized type of temporary person that can come and help us out. And that's actually on the GAP manager agenda for this Friday's meeting. Anyways, is there any questions you have? Or?
Any questions? Well, I had one. Well, first of all, it was great information, and the numbers are just amazing. You know, the first one that stands out, 4.91 billion gallons of wastewater were treated. That's really impressive. I'm curious if you have compared these numbers to MMWD numbers for our area. I'm just kind of curious because, I mean, obviously the drought year and wet year numbers vary, but I'm kind of curious how closely they...
Only in terms of, you know, how much water they deliver to the customers and how much then we receive?
Yeah. Anyway, it might be kind of interesting.
We haven't really, you know, compared those two closely, but generally, you know, well... One thing that's pretty obvious, the amount of water they use is going to be more than what is, you know,
right,
sent to the sanitary sewer system. And we did see during the drought years, we did see a reduction due to conservation of the amount of water that came in. Remember, that's when we had that situation where there was about a 20% reduction in water conservation overall in the service area, something like 20 million gallons per person, per population per year, per day, excuse me, to 17 or 18. But we saw a much more significant reduction here, and we thought, well, now why is that happening? And it turned out, remember, we had, you know, the weir calculation problems with the weirs, and we've adjusted that. So that's the first time we really looked into it. But there's not really a direct correlation between water use, a lot of it's because of irrigation use, and what gets in the wastewater system, unless you do some like flow measurement in different sub-basins and try to understand that a little better.
Yeah, probably not worth it. Yes, Tom.
I think it would make for a hilarious, like, Onion-type headline where CMSA is receiving twice as much.
Is the water district delivery? Where is that coming from?
See if anybody says anything.
During the summer, right?
Yeah.
There's no rain.
Tom, do you have something?
I'm looking at this one that I thought was very interesting. Unplanned corrective maintenance-related work. It's on page 2. It's the second bullet. So... we have a lot of unplanned corrective maintenance, more than our planned preventative maintenance. More the hour.
No, what are you looking at there?
Well, I'm looking at that ratio. So the preventative maintenance is less than the unplanned, although it's planned and unplanned.
Yeah, so it's...
It's planned and unplanned, okay.
And yeah. A lot of times the unplanned corrective maintenance over the years has decreased because we've expanded the preventive maintenance program.
Yeah.
And also a lot of the corrective maintenance we're scheduling out now also. Unplanned is if something breaks and we have to go fix it.
Sure.
But we you know, when there's some corrective maintenance we have to do to fix things, so we'll plan and do that. Well, preventive is different. That's more like, you know, oil changes, you know, lubrication changes, belt changes on pumps, replacing things when we know there's a certain kind of, you know, expected service life, so we'll prevent a maintenance activity to go replace, you know, like a flow meter maybe.
I was thinking that the ratio that you want would be planned versus unplanned.
Well, the metrics are on the table.
Yeah.
So if you look at the table,
yeah, okay,
you have the three different metrics. So you have preventative maintenance, number of hours,
okay,
then you have planned corrective, and it shows you the percentages and how that's calculated. Then you have unplanned, then there's the ratio. So then these targets you have, such as greater 70%, less than 30%, and greater than 0.45, mm-hmm. those are kind of national industry averages that you want to try to beat or at least achieve. And most of the time, we'll exceed the 70, greater than 70, less than 30, and greater than 0.45. But, you know, before we started tracking labor hours under the work orders, we were tracking another metric, I forget exactly, because it's been, you know, quite a few years now. And what we learned is that there's a lot of different ways to calculate the metric and track things. So we kind of shifted more to what was common in the utility industry. Did that make sense?
This validates what I've long suspected, is that shit happens.
Okay. We're on the record.
Are we on TV here?
Yes, this is being recorded.
This is on the record. Is the chair ready for a motion?
Yes, unless there is any member of the public who would like to speak to this. Okay, I would accept a motion to accept the report.
I move that we accept the report.
I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
I believe that was unanimous. Thank you. Agenda item 6, employee compensation and benefit adjustment process.
Thank you. So this is kind of a follow-up activity based on a discussion I had with Chair First prior to the November board meeting when the board had negotiated the letter of understanding with SEIU Local 1021. So, you know, that was all negotiated in closed session, issued a proposal, they accepted, then we had the LOU that we brought to the board. And when we met to review the agenda, Chair First asked, has the board always just approved these things just at a board meeting, just with one discussion and presentation? And that's been our practice, you know, as long as I've been here. And she had mentioned that in Corte d'Ivoire they use a two-step practice. So like if it's discussed in closed session and you reach an agreement and you have, say, a new contract or MOU or whatever form it takes, then the first one is more for just presentation, discussion, feedback. Then you have the approval of the second meeting. So she had said, well, maybe we should maybe think about that at CMSA or bring it to the board. So I offered, we have a finance committee meeting, you know, the next week or so. I put on the agenda. We discussed it and thought there's some value in bringing that to the board and even making a change. So that's why it's before the board tonight. Then the one question that staff has is how we actually implement this. Is it just kind of wholesale for any type of a compensation or benefit adjustment? Or should it just be for maybe more significant changes like through the labor relations negotiations process? Then I talked with a couple board members about those two options, and we thought, well, maybe what we do is we say it's for labor relations based adjustments, we need a two-step process. Sure. Then for all other ones, it can be at the discretion of the GM and the board chair if it should be appropriate to go through a two-step process or if it's lower level housekeeping and just have it a one-step process. So that's kind of, you know, the extent of the staff report, and I can receive any direction you want, but whatever you guys, if you decide something beyond the one step, then I bring back, you know, probably a personnel policy that we have and probably add some language to capture whatever the board's decision is so we don't forget about it.
And the reason I brought this up originally, and thank you for that, by the way, but the reason I brought it up is there had been some criticism in the county, not necessarily justified, that certain boards would vote on a consent calendar listing to approve a wholesale, you know, employee group pay raise, multi-year, you know, with significant, you know, fiscal impact, and that maybe they were trying to do it, you know, secretly or by not being really forthcoming with the public. So Corte d'Ivoire adopted the two-step process to simply to increase transparency, allow people plenty of time to find it on the agenda, because, as you know, when the agenda comes out on a Thursday or a Friday and the meeting's on Tuesday, you know, members of the public aren't always able to review that time. So anyway, that's the thinking. So Jason and I had discussed, again, where the cutoff might be. Yes, labor relations type agreements, more significant items, little housekeeping things that are extremely minor, not significant to the in fiscal impact. I don't think those necessarily need to be on two agendas over 2 months. But something that, you know, is a significant adjustment to a salary range or, you know, a negotiated employee group agreement, certainly would. So, any thoughts? Yes.
Well, so I discussed this, in fact, Michael and I discussed this with Jason, and we thought it might be useful to approve a two-step process for, you know, all of these, but that have exceptions if the general manager discusses it with, you know, the chair, and then it would be a one-step process. We could go to that. But, you know, approve a two-step process, but have exceptions that get reviewed.
Cam?
I have a question. Did I miss a discussion of the failings of the current policy if we're changing? Has there been, like, an
evaluation of that?
Sure.
No, it's just there have been complaints at the county level.
But not about this agency.
Not about this agency. About the fact that putting significant changes to compensation on a consent calendar item isn't something the public is always necessarily aware of. And it's just an effort to be a little bit more transparent
I understand
allow the public
the
plenty of opportunity.
Kind of the media coverage of the issue. I just wondered if there had been any specific requests that we change we do things.
Nothing, no requests specifically to CMSA, and to your first question, I haven't heard of any complaints about using the process we have now. But it does improve it gives more opportunity for the public to understand what's happening if they don't catch it the first month, and it increases, you know, the transparency of it.
It's an emerging issue.
Yes.
The interest, particularly compensation and particularly in pensions. So we should be willing to vote twice on it, if you will, to make darn certain that we, on behalf of our constituents, understand the issue and are willing to commit to it. It certainly can't hurt.
Is it easy to sort out the substantive versus those things that may not require two steps?
Yeah, I think so. So, like, for example, if we used Commissioner Gaffney's idea, just make a statement that we're going to adopt a two-step process, but, you know, there'll be some situations where the general manager and board chair would select single-step process. So we have a general, you know, direction like that. We'd write down a policy. Then, like, if I thought, okay, we're going to, say, adjust the salary for this associate engineer because there's only one person in the position, we're going to do recruitment, so we want to make sure we have a competitive salary range, so we do that. I may go to chair first and say, to bring it up to the average of the market comparators, which is our normal practice, we need a 4.2% salary adjustment for the classification. I may say, we should do that, and we should just put it in the consent calendar. She may say, that's okay, we do it. Or she may say, well, no way, that's pretty significant. We need to put that as a business item just for discussion and bring it back the second month. So it'll be kind of an ongoing dialogue in... not really a negotiation, but what are the shared sides?
We'll work it out, and if the policy doesn't work, needs tweaking, we will tweak it.
Okay. An example we talked about, too, is, like, say in that example, she agrees, we'll keep it on the consent calendar. Well, a board member thinks it's significant, it should be a two-step. They can pull it off and say, talk about it, we'll bring it back next month.
Yeah.
So it could always evolve into a two-step process if we make a decision that someone doesn't agree with.
Do we currently have a policy written that we have a one-step process on these items?
Or no, that's just that's our practice.
So we are going to create a new policy then?
We'll either create a new administrative policy that's outside our personnel policy manual, or we'll see if there's an applicable, you know, section of a personnel policy that we could add that to. Because I know we have a compensation administration personnel policy, so that could be where we could add it in there. But we'll bring some, if you like this, kind of like this decision, this direction to integrate that into a policy with some draft language, then we'd bring that back next month.
Great.
We'd either have a new policy or write into one.
Well, let's do two-step process or two-step process.
Corinne Rivera following, what is it, COST, C-O-S-T,
You're talking about COIN.
COIN, the transparency, is it?
Our version of it, no.
But I mean, that's where it started, was kind of a discussion of these recommendations.
The discussion at the county level seemed to coincide and was probably instigated when COIN was being pushed. Court of Madera did not adopt COIN, but has strived to increase transparency in maybe a couple of those provisions, but not all of them.
I just wondered if there were other agencies similar to ours who've adopted additional transparency measures that we might
I'm not aware of any myself.
See if, you know, are these the only things we should be doing?
Well, if you come up with any, let us know.
I'm just wondering, is this one of the things the grand jury, civil grand jury, talked about? Not that we follow them, but...
Yeah, not in any reports that we've received here.
Especially recently, yeah.
So you think, I know Larkspur went through this too. Court of Madera's kind of been exposed to this issue as much as anybody, I guess.
Did Larkspur adopt any changes?
Yeah. I don't know if they're the same ones, but as she described, we paid attention to what we were listening to, and we didn't do everything they were asking us, but we made an effort to improve from their point of view what we were doing.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. Any other comments?
All we have to do is provide
direction,
and we've kind of done that.
Yes. Well, any member of the public like to speak to this? Seeing none. You have your walking papers?
Okay, we'll draft
got it.
It's walking papers.
I'm sorry, not walking papers. I mean, take this.
We just want to
directions.
Get that in surreptitiously.
Yeah. No. I didn't mean it like that. I mean, to take this and go back to your office and work very hard on
sufficient direction.
Marching orders. That's what I meant to say.
The direction
forgive
we'll have
me.
The draft policy section next month to take a look at.
Okay.
For the purpose of transparency.
Great, thank you. All right, next up on the agenda, number 7, Solar Power Generation Report, 2017 Facilities Master Plan.
Thank you, Chair, first. So back in 2002, CMSA hired an engineering consultant, Brown and Caldwell, to prepare a solar power feasibility study for the agency. Because at the time, we had, you know, a couple board members that were very interested in solar power and CMSA potentially, you know, putting solar, you know, arrays all over the agency. And there were even some comments that we should spend our $8 million in reserves on solar arrays. So we hired Brown and Caldwell. We scoped out a pretty, you know, comprehensive, you know, feasibility study with them. And what it found was, what they did is they went around the site and they had certain criteria to use when selecting locations. And they did a fatal flaw analysis, and they removed a lot of the locations, such as over process tanks, over the holding pond, and other areas where it'd just be really expensive to build, you know, the structural support system for the array, or there could be, you know, access issues with, you know, to equipment and process tanks, or where we may need the land for some future, you know, treatment facilities. So after the fatal flaw analysis, they identified a series of locations, such as the roofs of the admin building and the maintenance building, covered parking out in the parking lots, the employee and the visitor parking lots, and 6 or 7 ground-level locations around the plant. And they costed those out, and the findings from that 2002 study were that we had the available land for realistic facilities for about 248 kilowatts of capacity. It'd be about $2.2 million at that time. The Public Utilities Commission had a self-generation incentive program that at the time had a 50% rebate for solar installations. So then the capital cost would be about $1 million. But the payback on that $1 million 248 kW system ranged from 19 years to 50 years. It was 19 years if it was tied to the power procurement cost at the time for PG&E, in 50 years if it was natural gas cost. Natural gas costs less, obviously. So we brought that back to the board, and the board chose not to spend our $8 million on solar arrays. So that was the decision. So as part of the facilities master plan, we included kind of a minor task to for the consultant to take a look at that 2002 study, peer review it, and update it. So that's what they did. So one couple of findings were that the locations that were identified in the 2002 study as being not very practical or feasible, they agree with those. Mm-hmm. And there were several areas where we had ground arrays in 2002 that weren't available because now we had a pump station, the contact tanks, expanded facilities over those areas. So it kind of winnowed it down to canopy, you know, parking structures with solar arrays on top, the surface mount systems for the two buildings, and a small ground array between our plant road and our storage pond. But, you know, in the last, 15 years, the price for the solar panels has decreased by 5 times, and the efficiency and output has doubled. So, first page of the staff report in this first table, you see the three locations, the size of the panel systems, and their capacity. And to know about the capacity, that's just maximum output during, you know, the summer months when you have the sun directly over the panels are in the right position, and you have high sun intensity on them. Most of the year, you're not going to have, say, for instance, 500 kilowatts. You'll have much lower than that. So then what the consultant did is they took those three array locations and they costed them out. And that's what you see in table 2 on page 2. And that's just the installation cost. That's procurement of all the materials and installation, for example, of the canopy system with the inverters mounted somewhere and the array system. But not really a conductor running from that system, like, say, to this building and tying it into our motor control center. That wasn't part of the cost, and that wasn't really in the scope. So you see the installation cost here. Then they looked at cash flow each year over a 20-year period and the net present value. Then they did the benefit cost ratio. So you see that for a CMSA, you know, owned facility where we hired a contractor and they procured materials and they built it and we became the owners, it's not very economically viable. Benefit cost ratio is less than one, then all the figures are negatives. And this does include not in the installation cost, but in the maintenance cost in the 20-year MPV calculation. It assumes that there'd be, you know, a cost to remove the panels on this roof in several years when we replace the roof. So that was kind of been integrated into the maintenance cost over time. So it didn't look very good. So then we asked Corolla, which was a little outside the scope, we said two things. One, aren't there any Energy Commission or Utilities Commission, you know, rebates or grants for solar? And they said there used to be, but not anymore. They say the solar initiative that expired and the self-generation incentive program doesn't cover solar anymore. It covers, you know, cogeneration and, you know, windmills and geothermal and these other categories, but not solar. So it's changed since 2002. Then we asked them, well, could you take a look at, you know, what if a third party came in and they designed, installed, and owned the facilities, and we had a power purchase agreement with them, and we bought the power. How the economics work out that way? Because we've heard that's how homeowners buy these facilities and private companies and things. So that analysis was done. That's one in the third table on page 2. So you see that it also assumes that we're buying the power at 9.5 cents per kilowatt hour, but then we're selling it for 10.5 cents to bring clean energy. And that cost doesn't include interconnection to our facilities either. So each array would have to get interconnected to an MCC that's closest to the array. And we didn't really look too closely at does the MCC have the capacity for the maximum, you know, output of the array. They did a high-level look, but they said you'd have to do more of electrical engineering analysis of that. That wasn't part of this scope of work. So then there's some attachments that just show, you know, generally where the arrays would be built and then kind of what they would look like, some illustrations of what they look like. But at this point in time, it doesn't look like that it's very economically viable for the agency to consider this further. But I think it was a good idea that we included this in the master plan and just updated the 2002 study. So I could answer any questions, or if you have questions I can't answer, I could bring those to Carollo and we could get the answers with the final report.
Thank you. Any questions?
So as I see it, the key consideration here is that we've got to compare this against power at 10 cents per kilowatt hour. And that's why it isn't working. It probably would work if
we bought all our power from PG&E or Brinkley Energy. When you integrate in all the power we buy, plus all the reservation charges and distribution and transportation charges and things like that.
Yeah. Aren't you eligible for net metering?
Why aren't we?
Yeah.
We didn't ask them to look into that. It's likely we would be eligible, but then we'd have to do another interconnection agreement with PG&E to see if there needs to be some other improvements to their system, given that we are making improvements for the current, new interconnection agreement. Mm-hmm. And we have to figure out where we'd interconnect. So there are some other cost factors mm-hmm. and variances that make the analysis a little more complicated and drive up the actual, construction costs. So we said, let's just keep it simple, tie into existing, distribution systems, and then we'd save the biogas generated power and just deliver that and sell that. Mm-hmm. That's how we scoped this task out.
Oh, that's how you did it.
Yeah.
Okay, so you were just offsetting.
That's right.
Oh, okay.
Because a year from now, if we have a power agreement, we're selling power. We could put in solar, but it's probably not going to, the utility is probably not going to buy the solar for what we could sell the biogas power for.
Right.
Because I think when I was talking with MCE, they said, solar right now is like 4 or 5 cents. Mm-hmm. Well, we had the reservation for 10.5. Even though we don't have an agreement with them, we use that in the calculations.
Right, if you're selling, but if you're net metering, then you get to offset the whole thing, not just the generation component, the whole thing. That's why net metering is so lucrative.
Yeah, we don't.
But I don't have commercial. I don't
buy much. But buy much power.
Yeah, so you don't have much to.
We assume that we'll be energy self sufficient.
Yeah.
And then. It's easy to make that assumption because then we kind of kept the scope really narrow because we're not buying the power, so we don't get that advantage of getting a credit back, a one-to-one credit, like, say, a homeowner would with the net metering system in place.
Right, that's where that would work. And just one other comment on the solar incentives are gone, but the solar plus storage incentives are still there. They still get the 50 cent rebate.
Solar plus storage. Okay.
Solar plus storage. If you put a battery with your solar system, but that would make it, that would increase your level of complexity by several orders of magnitude. Yeah.
And I know Napa Sanitation, they're not a large co-generator like us. Mm-hmm. And they, I learned about this at CASA conference presentation, and they put a large solar system in, mm-hmm. and they installed batteries, yeah. and the batteries were for their Tesla batteries.
Yep.
They sort of got them like almost for free.
You were there, yeah. You saw that presentation, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they were kind of given the batteries by Tesla, and nobody would ever get that deal again.
And Tesla said, "We're not going to do that again." Like we did with this public.
Well, I thought they did it for College of Marin.
Yeah, but not at the same rate. That,
are they pleased with the way it's working?
Maybe.
Yeah, they said, it's. Actually, he didn't really get into. This kind of said how, it's working, they're happy with the system for the most part, mm-hmm. but they really emphasized that it's not a good model for most agencies because you're not going to get the batteries at that significantly reduced price. Yeah.
And they just store it for their own use at a later time?
That's my understanding, yeah. So they shave the peaks, they collect the extra energy and they store it up, so then when, the cells are generating less, and cogeneration then needs some supplement. They have the battery power to help out, to deliver to their distribution system within their property.
And I understand it's the same model that Tesla used recently in Australia,
mm-hmm.
when they brought their batteries down there and sort of gave them to the Australians and said, yeah. It was a good test.
Yeah. We talked about, we're figuring out the scope here. We're meeting with the consultants before we issued the RFP, and we were talking about the different tasks and the scope. They asked some questions like that, but we saw, like what you said, that's going to be a huge capital component. and it's going to drive the economic. Well, one, it's going to be a lot more consultant dollars to evaluate that, and the cost benefit's not going to work out. So we tried to keep it as simplistic as we could, with as easy insulation as we could.
With the biogas, it's just.
Yeah, we're just in a different position as an organization.
Well, the scale required to make something economically viable is just, I mean, you're not even.
Well, for example,
well, price per kilowatt hour, that's what it was. It's 10 cents a kilowatt hour.
No, like you can
never get up below 10 cents.
It's a quick learning curve to realize how much you actually need to make something like this work.
In that 2002 study, because it had a much broader scope, they looked at actually what's the most power that would be generated each day by each array, and they added that up. When you looked at over the course, even though it was a 248 kW system, and you hear, Siemens say has a 750 kW generator, your average demand is 650. Well, if you have 250 here for the solar, that's most of your, that's like 40% of your plant demand. But it doesn't work that way because that's only maximum output. So they looked at what's the output each day maximum over the course of the year. You added it up. Then you looked at, how many million kilowatts it generates versus what we need over the year on average. It was like 3% of our demand was met by the 248. So if you escalate, then maybe it's 6%, but maybe we're more efficient, so it's maybe 8% to 500. So it doesn't help us out too much in terms of our demand.
Yeah, that tracks. You think this peninsula would offer an ideal location for stuff like that. I did the work at the prison looking at the state of what a reuse scenario would look like there. We included an energy project. And surprisingly, that fell in the same category. There was just not enough. I mean, you'd think that would be the ideal place to do a big energy project, like windmills and solar and all that kind of stuff. San Quentin prison property itself. Mm-hmm. No way. It's not nowhere big enough to do what you need. And the exposure daily, as he said, it just varies so much over the year that you don't get what you need.
Yeah. Not a reliable resource.
Well, I'm glad you did the study, because we always get questions, why aren't we doing solar, and why are you looking at that? So
See, you've worked for Las Galinas, because they had a big piece of land right on the ground level.
Right. Yeah.
They had someone come in and build it, and they're buying the power, and it's a lower price than they're paying, PG&E. So it worked out great for them.
And they got a lot of incentives too, right?
Yeah, they probably did, because it was several years ago they installed that.
Okay. Anything else? Any member of the public like to speak to this? Okay. Thank you. Moving on to discussion of the preliminary 5-year revenue plan.
Okay. So I'm glad the finance committee is here so they could help me out with this presentation if I forget something important. So just in terms of background, so we developed our first, multi-year revenue plan back in 2013. And, went through a process with the finance committee, the JPA managers, eventually brought it to the board and got adopted. It got communicated to the JPA agency, got integrated into their Prop 218 processes, and all worked out really well. Then each year when we're developing the agency's budgets, we, update the financial forecast. Then over the last few years, we've showed the board, high-level summary of, okay, if we don't have any, revenue increases, just from property owners and the members beyond FY18, which is the last year in this 5-year revenue plan, then we'll start drawing down our operating reserves, drawing down the capital reserves. Then around FY21, 22, and it shifts each year a little bit, we'll exhaust all reserves. So a couple years ago, we sent a letter to the JPA agency explaining, what was happening. Then 2 years ago, we sent another letter. We attached the prior year's letter, just keeping informed of what's happening on the financial side, and that we're going to have to go through this, revenue plan development process again. And we're going to propose the same type of process where everybody's kind of kept in the loop and write, comments and input and help with the development and refinement of it. And so we started that up this year with the finance committee in October. And it started with having an initial meeting where the finance committee reviewed the 10-year CIP. They reviewed the 10-year financial forecast, had a lot of good questions about why are we doing things these years, why are we using these types of escalators here, how does the mechanics work from the different, excess funds and operating moving into different reserves. So we had a good discussion on that, so everybody's on the same kind of general same page. And then we established some guiding principles for the development of the new five-year plan. And those are shown on page 3 of the staff report. And there are 7 principles that are on page 3. So the first 5 were what the committee and staff scoped out. The committee accepted those and said, staff, go ahead and develop your revenue model using these 5 principles. So we did that, got together in March, and we had 4 different scenarios to fully fund operating expenses, maintain the operating reserve, then different levels of capital funding. So on page 3, you see there's an alternative 2. So the committee honed on that one because the rate increases were less, and that's because we were issuing some form of indebtedness to pay for a couple large capital projects. So we're spreading the cost over time. So the committee said, well, we think, you know, issuing debt makes a lot of sense to keep the rates a little lower, at least the capital component of the rates. And they advised us in December, why don't you go ahead and look at how you can issue debt for more capital and bring the rate down below 4%. So we did that. And Ken, I have to acknowledge, Ken did great work developing the model and then preparing the scenarios. And I told him he didn't have to come tonight because he has a really good dinner every night at 7:30. I said, don't worry about coming in. You know, I'll try to explain all this. I have the committee there to help me. So we looked at variations of alternative 2. And what we did is we took the 10-year CIP, which is attached. It has all the color coding on it. Mm-hmm. And we identified all the bigger projects, and we figured, okay, over the 5 years, we'll issue some form of debt or apply for some loan, like the State Water Board loan, and pay for all these projects. So then we had a variation of the alternative 2, but there was a spike in there the year that we were going to issue the debt. Mm-hmm. So then we tried to we reconstructed using some reserves in some of the years to balance out over the 5 years, and that's what's shown on page 1. And so we've talked with the committee members independently over the last few days about this option, and they thought that makes a lot of sense, have a bigger form of debt issuance, keep the rates below 4%. So tonight, we're just looking for some board, you know, feedback and direction on, do you agree with the guiding principles? Do you agree with, you know, using some form of indebtedness for major capital projects in the next 5-year planning period?
Okay. Walk me through again how you got from alternative 2, which has a 5.9% increase in fiscal year 23, to a 3.3% increase on page 1.
So in alternative 2, the 2 capital projects that were in that debt issuance, mm-hmm, were the new cogeneration system, mm-hmm, and new centrifuges. Mm-hmm. 2 very important pieces of equipment that have a long service life and are the most expensive, except for structures at the agency. So what we did is we bundled a lot more capital projects into the debt issuance. So those 2 capital projects, it was like a $6 million debt issuance, mm-hmm, six and a half. The debt issuance associated with the table on page 1, mm-hmm, is more of close to like $16
million.
So it's everything else. It's roof rehabilitation. It's major secondary clarifier improvements. It's replacement of diffusers in, you know, the primary influence channels, grit tanks, and air compressors.
But it's all capital. We're not borrowing.
Yeah, it's all big capital.
Big capital. Okay.
So there's two pieces. There's the indebtedness for the big capital, and there's also a capital fee increase for pay as you go for smaller capital activities. Mm-hmm. Such as, you know, kind of scheduled replacement of pumps and various, you know, slider sluice gates or flow meters or MCC buckets and other components, PLCs, things like that.
And is the $16 million in increased debt reflected in this 10-year plan?
Yeah, that's all pieces in this. So if you look from fiscal year 19 to 23, that's a 5-year period. Mm-hmm. Like some of the items are bio tower road redistributor replacement out in FY23 of $988,000. So that's included in the debt issuance. Everything that's, you know, big, we included in the debt issuance, mm-hmm, that are in those 5 years in the CIP. And, you know, a note on the CIP here, this is different than the CIP that's in the FY18 budget. Because what we did here is we rolled in a lot of the recommended activities from the condition assessment work from the master plan and pulled those into the CIP after we did a thorough vetting internally with our capital project team. And that's what the green cells represent.
Okay, the green cells are what?
The green cells are either existing projects that were expanded due to the condition assessment recommendations or just new projects that weren't in the CIP based on the condition assessment work.
Okay, so beyond what's in the green is finance through borrowing.
Most of the green is borrowing. Some things in the green aren't borrowing. Yeah. That's just all the condition assessment recommendations
okay,
rolled into it.
Coincidence. That has nothing to do with borrowing. Okay.
You okay? All right, Tom.
Yep. So really, here's the situation. We want to finance the entire CIP over the 10-year period. And we went through these guiding principles, and I kind of like to add as a guiding principle that we want to fund pay-as-you-go for capital to the reasonable extent possible. And we would fund the rest from issuance of debt to the reasonable extent possible. And this is a very, what we call it, aggressive capital improvement program. It's $46 million. And if we sell about $19 million, we're still figuring out the numbers. But we could have one $9 million issue in about 4 years and a $10 million issue about 6 years after that. And we can level out our rate increases to 3.5% a year. And we're still funding, what, $27 million pay-as-you-go. And we wouldn't decide right off the bat to sell those bonds. That would be a decision well in the future. And what probably will happen is it's very difficult to do all of these capital improvement programs. All $46 million, I don't know if we have the staff that could do all this. It's difficult. And so there's a lot of financing safeguard built into this. We may not even need the second issue. But we did take a look, and all the way out for the next 10 years, for the next 9 years, we can fund this entire program at 3.5% rate increases for the 9 years that we have to go. At least it looks like it. And that maintains our capital reserve at a level of about $5 million or so. And that was another one of our guiding principles that we felt we might add, is that we'd like to maintain our capital reserve balance roughly equal to the average capital improvement, 1 year capital improvement program. Right now we have a capital reserve of about $6 million. That's very good. It's helped us with this financing program. So anyway,
I have a question. Is the expected schedule for completing the CIP also 10 years? Is that your...
Well, then after 10 years, we're going to have another $40 million worth of projects. Believe me, it never ends with wastewater. Mm-hmm. So we fund all these projects, and in fact, staff will be upgrading the CIP every year.
Every year, yeah.
But it doesn't drop us off a cliff. That's the good thing. Potentially we could be doing 3.5% rate increases. Well, at least for 9 years, anyway. It seems like it'll work. And it provides a reserve in the final year, a reserve of over $5 million.
What was your financing presumption?
25-year, 3.7%. And a 2% issuance cost. That's about right. I'll tell you something, the best thing about the program, the real safeguard, is that we probably won't be able to build all these projects. And so that just means, what do? We defer them. So we don't want to just forget about them, But anyway, it gives us a lot of time to plan.
Right, and we can defer the financing as well.
Defer the bond, yeah.
But this is, I had a question about the decision to go with 25-year bonds, because the life of these assets are not necessarily 25 years.
Yeah, they're at least 25 years.
I thought the clarifier was 20 years, right?
Well, say a new cogen engine, that might be 20 years we will maintain that time period. Centrifuges, you know, cogen and centrifuges, 15, 20 years. I mean, you could even keep longer than that if they're well maintained. But
maybe we could do 20 years then. I did do 25. And by the way, the way the bonds would work is we don't actually pick this project and that project and that. We finance the capital improvement program. And it's the bond is basically a cash flow bond. And if, as I understand, we learn that, gee, the projects are less than 25 years, yeah, we wouldn't extend it that long. I was thinking you were going to say, gee, let's go 30 years. And I'd rather not do that. I'd rather go on the shorter end.
Right. Well, that's my concern, is I don't want to be burdening future ratepayers for assets that have already been
gone.
Retired.
Yeah. That's right.
So, yes, Dave.
Yeah, being the new kid on the block and taking a look at just the history of this plant and having a little bit of experience at the wastewater plant in the East Bay and stuff, this is a very solid plan of capital improvements, especially for something that's 41 years old now. And it's like the first major, from headworks to the outfall complete renovation, but it is a significant amount of work that's needed to get done on this plant to keep it running for the next 30 years with some pretty solid projects here that were very well vetted. We in the finance committee, we had Jason and his staff not only try to first prioritize which ones are high priority, which ones are low priority, and to push the lower priority ones further out, and even to sort of level the CIP to so we don't have really big spikes or, you know, all the most expensive projects aren't occurring in the same year. So we went through a process with his staff to prioritize and to level things out too, so we don't have some massive spikes. And also with the realization that Tom was referring to is like, you know, we only have so much staff here to manage resources to even get all this work done. So in reality, this is probably going to end up being a 15 to 20 year plan. But with the highest priority stuff getting done first and to make sure that our plant doesn't go down and it is well maintained. So with seeing all that good work going through, I was pleasantly surprised to see that we're not that much higher above CPI, which is 2.73% for the November to November calculations of last year. So it's very palatable increase for all the work we're getting done, plus the just basic CPI raises that our staff gets and cost of materials and living in the Bay Area is all about. So to me, it's a very well thought out and easily supportable rate increase to get behind, in my estimation. And it can be very well explained.
It has been.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, Tom.
I was thinking then, that was a good point about the life of the projects. I think I would prefer that we have level rate increases, like, you know, 3.55 all along. But I think we ought to instruct our staff to take a look at the life of facilities if we have to go to 20 years and see what happens and try to project level increases. And we did it for the 10-year period. You know, we can only approve rates for 5 years that we're planning, but we wanted to check what happens after 5 years. And so, you know, we want staff to check it for 10 years.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And maybe, I mean, that's what I prefer. I'd like level rate increases. I'd like you to see what happens if some of these projects are shorter term. Remember, though, we're going pay-as-you-go for $26 million. So we could aim the pay-as-you-go at the shorter term projects and pick the longer life projects for the financing.
Well, and the other thing is that not all of the longer life projects are going to be done in year one. there might be a project done in year 3, and then there might be a project done in year 17. Yeah. So perhaps 25 is a decent average. But I just want us to think about that and go into it knowing that that's what the strategy is, rather than just kind of picking it because we like how the bottom line stays under 4%. But thank you to the committee for
thank you very much.
Any other comments? Any member of the public? Do you have sufficient feedback?
Yeah, so just for staff and for the record, does the board support the guiding principles that the committee established? With so Commissioner Gaffney suggested another one being using pay-as-you-go for capital funding is reasonable.
To the reasonable extent.
Reasonable extent. Mm-hmm. So we can add that. Then he proposed over the 10-year period, looking at maintaining, you know, 5 or 6 million reserves. Is that something we want to try to target also?
Yes.
Yeah, I think
don't we have a 25% reserve policy?
That's on the yes we do, but that's on the operating side to help the operating.
And there's a 25% coverage. Remember that. So there's a couple of those 25.
Yeah, covered. Yeah, that's a rate covenant requirement. Yeah.
Maintain a capital reserve equal to about the average annual CIP. Mm-hmm. 1 year's average. And I don't think we normally want to put in our guiding principle an average rate increase less than. I mean, for this time, we really wanted to do it. I don't know, maybe it was a target increase. You'd like to keep it.
I think having some statement about that is helpful.
Okay.
Shall we thought about it?
You could say a modest increase. Currently, the board has determined that will be 4%.
Yeah, not to exceed 4%. Yeah. Well, see, this, you know, for all of us, this gets passed right on, and in our case, it's probably about half of our budget. And so it's going to have a huge impact on what we bring to the public.
Yep.
Well, it seems like a very prudent means to capture the relatively low cost of capital right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, great. So we'll go ahead and plan another committee meeting, and we'll bring back a revision of this plan to the board probably next month. Okay. And I think the committee staff targeted trying to wrap this up around the March time frame.
Okay.
I think it's a great idea to have a 5-year capital program, too, for us to vote on a 5-year rate increase, because then all of our satellite agencies have a plan.
Exactly.
And the greatest idea is to have a working committee to go through all of that and bring us a well-vetted proposal. So thank you for that.
Thanks for all the great comments. Thanks to the committee also. Great work over the last few months.
All righty, moving on. Agenda item 9, schedule a special meeting to discuss CMSA's renewed NPDES permit.
So the permit is going to be presented tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. to the Regional Water Board. And, you know, in talk with Monica Oakley, we're anticipating that they're going to adopt CMSA permit. And if they do that, then, you know, we have to follow the provisional new permit. It's possible that Ross Valley and or San Rafael will appeal that permit to the State Water Board. So once the permit's adopted, assuming it happens tomorrow, there's a 30-day time period for you to file your appeal with the State Water Board. So I'm talking with Monica Oakley. You guys will meet probably, you know, in a month or two when she presents the permit. She said, well, either CMSA could just let the members appeal if they do and see what happens, or CMSA can join their appeal as an agency, or CMSA can appeal on their own. And one thing that might be worth considering in terms of appealing on our own is that this whole joint and several, you know, issue with the members being co-permittees and have their own requirements, and if those aren't met, or if we don't meet one of our requirements, it could be through a lawsuit that then we're held, there's some liability for us for others not meeting their requirements. And that was a comment in the Ross Valley and San Rafael comment letter to the Regional Water Board, and they responded to those comments last Friday. Mm-hmm. And I'm paraphrasing here, but their response to that particular joint several comment, was requesting specific language to say agencies are responsible only for the things that they don't get done, what others don't do, was that they believe that there was enough differentiation of responsibilities in the permit that that's a non-issue. So they weren't going to add any particular language to that regarding joint several. Because they did say in the permit, normally a permit just says discharge everywhere. So now it's very clear about CMSA is responsible for this, Ross Valley that, San Rafael this. So they added language that they thought was, you know, good delineating who's responsible for what in the permit. Because we're responsible for most things, the CMSA agency. So Monica said, well, that's one thing. We wanted to still be involved in the appeal process. We could appeal just that joint and several issue. But, you know, assuming it's adopted, assuming that there is an appeal, then we probably need to have a special board meeting within the 30 days, and we'd bring in a regulatory consultant, someone besides that works with Downey Brandt, who San Rafael and Ross Valley are using, and they could walk through the different options with the board in closed session, and then the board can make a decision what they want to do. If the board decides to file some form of appeal, either our own for certain provisions or with Ross Valley, we can get direction to the regulatory attorney, and they could submit the appeal within the 30 days. So we added this to the agenda, you know, on Friday before it went out, after my discussion with Monica. And I have talked with Kent Alm, who's with Myers Nave, and he does a lot of, you know, general counsel work for several wastewater agencies in the Bay Area. And he said his firm is available to help, and they have a, you know, a specialized regulatory consultant in the LA office that's available to help out too. And I told him it's a limited scope. It's just attending a special board meeting to review the options, and then maybe there's some direction to do something.
So what's happening tomorrow? Is that
they're considering the final order of the permit. And the permit now has CMSA and the three satellite agencies, which are the JPA members. The other satellites, the county and the state, aren't included.
So I'm wondering if there's, you know, our staff and Michael are going to go tomorrow. We might, as a board, discuss it in closed session, and I wonder if San Rafael is going to...
We have a meeting, I think.
What is your board meeting?
It's
the last Monday of the month.
Right. The fourth one, the 22nd. Must be the 22nd.
Well, I was wondering if we should schedule a special meeting after both you and Evan. We meet next week.
Next week, okay. So maybe the week of the
29th.
The week of the 29th, because this is due. So if it comes out on the 10th, the 30 days of September. So it's due on the 9th of February. That would give enough time. So let's see, and that would be the fifth week, so nobody would have anything going on that week. Yes, let's do that.
Oh, you nailed us.
Can't get out of it now.
No excuses.
And just for symmetry, do we want to do it on the Tuesday the 30th?
Tuesday the 30th.
To be on Tuesdays?
It's possible.
Yeah.
It's my son's birthday.
You know, it may be helpful.
That stops the world.
Yeah, the pony. I don't think
we're going to
do a pony coming for Paula's birthday.
Are we going to have it during the day?
Yeah.
We could have it anytime you guys like. We could have it in the morning. We could have it in the evening.
We could have it Wednesday.
It'd just be a relatively short closed session.
Oh, that's right. We could have it during the day. Oh, well.
I would not be able to attend during the day. I suppose I could participate by telephone, but that gets complicated then.
It may be worthwhile to select two dates, because I need to talk with the attorneys and see, because they may not be available on one of the dates.
And then we may not need it, right?
We may not need it.
That's true, it may not happen.
We may decide that, gee, we don't want to appeal.
So we could select a couple dates, I could talk to the attorney, we could set one tentatively, and we'll see what happens with San Rafael and Ross Valley meetings.
Okay.
And if there's no appeal, I'll let you guys know, we won't, then we'll cancel the meeting.
Sounds good. Yeah.
So we won't officially set the meeting until we hear.
It might be good to know the consequences, you know, to just have somebody explaining the consequences.
Yeah, get another set of eyes on the provisions, can't hurt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the 30th at 7, it would be my
thought, is there another?
What does that do for you, Dean?
Paul's 20.
It's going to be 26.
It's going to be 26.
we have cookies here.
We got cookies, yeah. We'll put down happy. Yeah. We'll have a happy
birthday. If you buy pizza, he'll be there.
Okay, so I'm putting it on
tentatively
the
30th.
Do you want to say the 30th or the 31st, depending on if the attorney can't make it?
We still have five without you.
Or the 29th.
How's availability on the 31st?
Yeah. Okay. All available, anytime that week.
Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, is that okay?
Yes.
Yeah.
Monday,
Tuesday,
okay, Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday.
Okay, so you can hold those, and we'll see. I'll let the attorneys know. We'll see which one works for them. I'll pick one. I'll email you and tell you this is the date that the attorneys find to hold, and we'll see what happens with the members, and if there's an appeal that's, we won't know if the appeal is actually in, but if they make a determination to appeal, we'll assume it's going to happen then, and we'll set the special meeting and post it. And
from CSMA's point of view, it's a good permit, isn't it?
Oh, it's a great permit. It's better than our current permit.
Why is it better? Because you passed off responsibility.
well, not saying that, but some of the actual sampling requirements are reduced in this permit. Okay. There's nothing in the permit that requires any operational studies or any special reports or any investment in any new infrastructure. And in the prior permits, there were all kinds of activities that we had to do to allow us to continue blending. Now that's what's been shifted now to the members. Bad for the members, good for CMS.
Well, this all started because we wanted to save about $12 million. Mm-hmm. And we're saving $12 million.
Right.
And we're maybe giving ourselves some more exposure. That's what the attorneys are calling it.
Okay.
Okay.
So if there was an event at one of, like, say, for San Rafael, we had spillage out in the street or something, and is that's covered under this permit now, or is it covered under a permit that San Rafael already has?
So San Rafael doesn't have an MPDS permit. Right. They are regulated under the waste discharge requirements of the state. But having an SSO, that's a violation of the Clean Water Act.
Yeah, right.
So San Rafael would be liable for that anyways.
Right.
And because it's a violation of the Clean Water Act, it's still subject to, you know, third-party lawsuits. So what I don't know the details is, but there's all these other requirements in the state's waste discharge requirements. So now by bringing that into the MPS permit, then the third-party lawsuits then could, the legal theory is that they could then be applied to other provisions in the state's waste discharge requirements, such as maintaining certain capacity or providing certain capacity in your system, maintaining your system properly, a lot of these kind of more general requirements. That's what, you know, the attorneys, you know, are concerned about. Mm. It's not necessarily SSOs.
Try to do this thing, you know.
And for CMSA, for us to be tied into that, that's the risk for us right now.
Again, it's a theoretical risk. I mean, I don't know how real it would be. If you ask, you know, the attorney, you'd say,
yeah, it's real.
It's real. It could happen. But would it happen? You know, maybe not. I wouldn't think so. But I mean, I don't know.
It's definitely a change.
From
the way it used to be that the constituent members were not on the permit, and we prefer it.
Now, surprisingly,
that way, yeah.
Right.
Now, prior to the 2002 permit, the members were in the permit.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then they were removed from the permit, and now they're looking at adding them back in the permit.
Hmm.
And Melissa Thorne with Downey Brand, who's representing San Rafael and Ross Valley, she discovered this. We didn't know about it here because that's, you know, four permits ago. Mm-hmm. Anyway, there's a little bit of history.
Hmm.
There is some precedent to it.
Huh. Yeah. And there's other wastewater satellite agencies that are included in other permits. Like East Bay Mud has, you know, an MPS permit, and their satellites all have their own MPS permits now through an EPA consent decree or cease and desist order, right? Mm-hmm. And the Palo Alto San Jose JPA treatment plant, Palo Alto's the city's collection system and San Jose's collection system are included in that JPA's permit. So the Regional Water Board points to some of these in their response to the comments as being these set the precedent.
Sounds like sometimes it's this way and it's whatever's in fashion.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Moving on, North Bay Watershed Association report. All right, I attended that. We started out with a report by Ellie Cohen of Point Blue on the climate change program in Bonn, Germany. It was very interesting. She definitely was rubbing elbows with all kinds of folks. The real takeaway that I got is that local, state, and nonprofits are working together in the absence of Trump administration efforts to deal with climate change. So that's really kind of exciting, and evidently everybody's looking at California as continuing to be a big leader in this area. So don't think that because we're at a Paris Accord as a nation, things are stopping. That's not the case at all. And the rest of the world is evidently recognizing that.
We did, the United States did send a contingent to that UN meeting. And they had a conference that was called Safe Coal and Gas. And I guess there were the protesters went and started singing during it, but not all at once, so that each group was escorted out.
Yeah, so a group would start singing, they'd get escorted. Then they'd start up again, next group would start singing. Stage protest. Anyway. There was some talk about sequestering carbon, and according to Ellie, we can sequester 20% of carbon with better agricultural and soil management, which kind of led to the next speaker, who was Charles Schember of the Napa RCD Resource Control District? Resource Conservation District, that's it. So Napa Resource Conservation District. He's a soils expert, and it was really interesting. So I could totally nerd out on soil, but I will try to just cover a couple of big points. There has been much more research on soil in the last 3 years than in the last couple of decades before that. Soil is offering the greatest carbon, or is the greatest carbon sink, but it's also the greatest carbon emitter. And presumably that's through, you know, the growth of plants. Anyway. Healthy soil has many benefits, including it holds carbon, it holds and filters water, supports plants, animals, and humans, as in for food, and provides stability to eliminate erosion. So what he calls the plow layers, 6 to 7 inches, and that's really kind of the key part that they're looking at. Oregon State University is the West Coast leader in offering soil health assessment. UC Davis does some soil assessment, but they charge a ton of money, over $1,000. Oregon State does it for $155 and gives a lot of really cool information, such as active organic carbon, potentially mineralizable nitrogen. I hope I got that word right. Microbial respiration, meaning the CO2 respiration. Various chemical properties and also the physical properties. I mean, is it sticking together or is it just falling apart, whatever. He discussed at length a sustainable demonstration vineyard, which is, I believe, in the Carneros area, where they have a parcel and they do various programs that they implement on different portions of the parcel. There are some right next to a waterway, so they do some riparian things. They have a little orchard there. Anyway, so they're doing all kinds of stuff to
kind of learn what is best and then sharing that with the farmers, especially the vineyard operators in Napa County. And that was kind of the bulk of it. Is there something you want to add?
One other. Ellie Cohen, that used to, Point Blue used to be the Point Reyes Bird Observatory, but it's become Point Blue, which is all about climate change now. One of the things she was talking about is that, you know, natural gas was supposed to be this clean energy that would save us all. One of the byproducts of making natural gas through the fracking method, which is the major one, is methane. There's a tremendous amount of methane that's released. And it is of much higher consequence to global warming than carbon is. It's got a shorter lifespan than carbon, but they got to figure out how. It used to, you know, when Reagan, remember, he said the biggest source of methane was the cows, which is what everybody thought, but it's actually the fracking is what it's determining now. So that's a big problem with natural gas production.
And then just one last thing. Ellie also passed around a book that I thought was very interesting. It's the Carbon Free City Handbook, put out by the Rocky Mountain Institute. So I'm sure it's online, but it had some really awesome ideas for how to get your city to be carbon free. So,
plant trees.
A lot more than that.
I'm out of trees.
And you have to plant fewer trees if you just read the book online, PDF rather than paper copy. All right. Oral reports by commissioners. Anybody? General manager?
Just my handout. We talked about most of these things, the NPS permit, SRDs, you know, board appointment. Just one thing, just follow up from last month's board meeting that we did, you know, talk to a HR recruiting firm, Coffin Associates, that did a lot of work for us, and also other types like class and comp studies and things, and asked if they could just be our full-time recruiter for all different types of classifications. They said they'd be glad to help us with that. So we did, you know, contract with them to conduct the recruitment for the electrical instrumentation technician position that was approved by the board last month.
One other quick thing. Tomorrow, if anybody's interested, once a month, the Marine Coalition, which is an interesting group, meets at McGinnis Park at noon. And they usually have some really good speakers and topics. And tomorrow's is transportation in Marin, which I'm sure is going to be extremely well attended. And the woman who's in charge of the MTA is going to be talking. And you can just walk in. You have to pay for lunch, which is terrible.
Okay. Anything else? Seeing none, that's adjourned to our next scheduled meeting, Tuesday, February 13th, not including, of course, the special meeting already discussed. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.